Welcome. Today is the 23rd of March, 2016, and you're listening to the Audis Operi podcast with Ryan Grant of Athanasius Contramundum. And today we are joined by Father Ioannis Petrus, a missionary priest who gives missions, not so much a missionary in foreign lands, and just about general issues, a wide-ranging conversation on the church, tradition, and where things are today. Father, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here, Ryan.
So the first thing, we're in an election year, and it seems to be a very crazy election year, again, just as last time. And I don't know about anyone else, I tuned out of elections quite a long time ago, but it seems to just like that in past years we had candidates people gravitated to and say, okay, well, this is the guy we're going to get behind, even though we don't really know anything about him, and he's probably bad news. And whereas the last couple rounds of, the reality show from hell, as I like to call it, we haven't had anyone to gravitate to. There isn't, even though I don't like Reagan that much, I mean, a Reagan candidate, you know, unified people got behind him and said, this is our guy. This is, you know, the person who's going to be our guy. We don't have a Reagan or anything near it. So we see everything just seems to get downhill and downhill. What's your estimation of the current selection, I should say, and where Catholics should stand in terms of voting in elections?
Well, it's a very good question. In my estimation, which is probably not worth a lot, I suppose, when it comes to politics, I'm not an expert on politics, but I think if you apply Catholic principles, you can come up with some things. And one of the principles is that our job is to limit evil, to resist evil as best we can, to be counter-revolutionaries in the revolutionary time in which we live. We should do our best to limit and resist in any way we can. So I think one of our tendencies today is, as Americans, is to see the ideal candidate. And if we don't see him, we tend to project upon one we like and make him that ideal candidate. And we'll look for the pro-life candidate, and that's very logical. Because if you're against life, well, what else is the person going to be good for? That's a high-level principle with life. So if you're against life, well, then you're going to be against a lot of good things and for a lot of bad things. So a lot of people start at pro-life. But the problem is that that's not always... I don't know how to put this. It's in our current political system, that may actually be counterproductive, because ultimately these people are not able to do much in that regard anyway. So you could even have someone who's not totally for life act in a way that was actually more productive in getting rid of abortion than someone who's completely pro-life. So, I mean, take it or leave it, I think there's some truth to that. But what I want to get at, though, is simply this. Our job is to limit the evil and to do what we can to resist the evil. So when you look at candidates, there's a tendency to look for the ideal. If you look at the candidates instead as who is most likely to limit the evil the most, which candidate is most likely to limit the evil the most, you will probably get a better view of how to deal with a current political election crisis than you will by saying, oh no, this guy's more pro-life than the other guy. And there may be truth to that, but he may be completely off basis on limiting the overall evil facing us. So I think this is where a lot of people go wrong, and they end up eliminating a candidate, I think, unnecessarily. So I don't know if that's expressed as clearly as possible, but if you look back in the pontificates of Pius the 11th and 12th especially, they worked very hard at limiting the evil that was coming upon the world. They saw it and they knew it was coming, and they did the best they can to make it a softer landing. You could think of it like that. I mean, so I like to tell people that America is going in for a crash, and it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time, but we've got to do the best we can to soften the landing. And if you get too idealistic, basically you're not going to vote at all. or you're going to vote in some candidate that's never going to make it. And you want to, if you're thinking in terms of limiting the evil, you can actually eliminate a lot of candidates, and one candidate who you may find distasteful, but actually will be the one that's most likely to soften the fall. So, I mean, that's how I would approach this election crisis. Try to avoid getting involved in the personal back and forths and mudslinging at times that can happen, and ask yourself, you know, which of these guys is most likely to limit the evil?
But even there, I guess let's talk about not voting, because looking at the, you know, the evil, whenever, my view anyway, why I haven't voted in quite some time at the national level, at the local level, yes, but not at the national level, is just because, I mean, one, my personal belief is it's all rigged, but even failing yes. that, even failing that, if that's shown not to be true or can't, I couldn't substantiate it. Still, on the other hand, if it's not all rigged, polls show that voting does very little to actually influence policy. And when you vote for someone, you basically cast your vote of support for their policies, which over and above questions of abortion, then it's, well, how about, you know, foreign wars, bombing, dropping bombs on innocent people in other countries. You become responsible now for that vote.
Exactly.
Especially if the candidate said we're going to do that, where all the indications are that they will.
Yeah.
And then second thing is, can we really trust the candidate when they say, you know, because you look at Bush, you know, ran on the anti-war ticket, mm-hmm. didn't take long before world police again. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, all over the world, and Obama also ran on the anti-war ticket, and then lo and behold, he started many more wars than George W. Bush did, and he's dropped more bombs and drone warfare. He's actually killed American citizens abroad, and without trial, which, you know, and then people get lulled into the Muslim bit. Oh, well, they're, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki is a Muslim, you know, but he's an American citizen. It shouldn't matter. If we really believe in the Constitution, we wouldn't be supporting assassinating an American citizen abroad for, you know, this type of reason. And, you know, I guess we'll talk about the Muslims again in a little bit. But it just seems to me people get whipped up in this kind of fervor.
Well, they make their politicians.
We got a bomb over there.
They make their politicians almost like messiah figures. We're forced into that role.
Right.
We make them more than what they can do. We make them out to do more than they can do. Mm-hmm. And it is dialectical. I mean, there are games being played that we fall into these dialectics. Mm-hmm. To me, that's one of the things we need to avoid the most in the modern times, is falling into a dialectic with a president or a leader or even just movements in the world, because before long we can be participating in an evil cause and almost without knowing it. We're trying to do the right thing, but they can use people who are goodwill to do their bidding. That's where the dialectics have led today. It's very scary. It's like you got to be very cautious about what you do.
Would you say that a Catholic is morally obligated to vote?
Well, that's an interesting point, and it's my understanding that Pope Pius XII mentioned it numerous times that they should vote, but interestingly enough, that was not repeated, I believe, since that time. But recently, in the last presidential election, the bishops did come out and state that they understood why someone may not want to vote, and that was a valid option. So I'm pretty sure that's in the actual USCCB voting guide,
right,
where you could be so disheartened with what you're faced with in voting that you could not vote.
Right. What about as a general principle? Because I find it odd that you look at the older books from the 1920s and 1930s that talked about, you know, by Catholic priests that talked about American patriotism, and they would basically put your obligation to vote under the category
Fourth Commandment.
Yes, but it seems to me kind of novel, because, you know, this is a very recent thing, the idea of every man voting. And secondly, when the state confers a right, that doesn't necessarily mean it gives an obligation either.
Yeah.
So it would be one thing to put under the Fourth Commandment if it was like in Australia, where you're mandated by law, by the government, the authoritative government, to vote. But if it's not, it's like, well, you have a right to vote. You also have a right to remain silent. But,
yes,
but by no means do you have an obligation to.
Well, I think that one thing you could argue is that by voting, you do express, at least in some way, to someone somewhere, you express a concern. So you could put in, I vote for our Savior, you know, the Lord and King of the universe.
Right.
I mean, and then someone has to read that, hopefully. And they say, whoa, you know, look at this.
Right.
You know, this person is fed up so much that he's voting for Christ the King, you know. But I think you're right, and very much so, in that we're living in revolutionary times, and all the republics are revolutionary. So we're dealing with a certain acceptance of the revolution among us, and we're wondering how to deal with that. Thus, the idea we must vote. Well, I don't know about that. Like you said, there's no precedent for this in the history of Christendom, I think, as far as, you know, this right to vote. I mean, was there voting back in Florence? Was there voting? How what kind
not
of
for everybody?
Not for everybody.
Right.
Only those that were qualified, whatever. So there was, you know, there was careful selection of those who would vote, those who understood what was at stake. Now, I've heard the argument made where someone would state, well, I'm not voting because I really am not qualified to vote. And I mean, I've told this to others, and they're like, oh, that's ridiculous. But in one sense, you think about it. Well, I mean, am I really able to understand the candidates and what's at stake to the degree I could actually vote, make an informed decision and make a vote? And that's, you know, there is some interesting, though. These people are deceptive. They're playing games with us. I mean, are they who they say they are? And when I vote, am I voting for a charlatan? Am I voting for the real thing? And do I really understand? I mean, I can understand why someone would hesitate to vote on those grounds. But, I mean, I'm sure there's more moral reasons for voting and not voting than we're giving today. But
right.
Those would come to mind.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think it'd be more productive for Catholics instead to reach out in their local communities and try to network and say, you know, yeah, we can do these things? And it's more or less set up, because you look at, there's a Russian researcher, Dmitry Orlov, and he had been to the West and he traveled in the Soviet Union extensively at his fall. And what he found was that a lot of the communities outside the major urban centers, especially outside of Moscow, you found that communities actually network with each other. They were growing their parallel economy and their own private initiatives, and they pay off the local political officer, and so he wouldn't squeal about it. And so he's benefiting, so he's tied into the system too, and also will be punished too. So then, so when the Soviet Union did fall, then immediately in all these outer areas outside of the major cities, then, you know, these local economies sprang up. And you had, it was hard and it was difficult, but at the same time, the people could weather it because they did have alternative means of production and getting things done already established, or just waiting for the national government to fall. So that you look at America, on the other hand, and Hurricane Katrina, I think, is illustrative of this. If the power goes out and the trucks stop rolling, what do you do? 99% of people are not prepared for that at all. And there will be things like you saw in Katrina far more on a much larger scale. So doesn't it seem like the real thing that we should be doing is trying to create these parallel economies in, you know, rather than focusing, you know, on the horror show in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. What's the old saying? Politics always is local, or it starts local.
Right.
If you build up local, then you're in a much better position to handle more larger scale politics. Absolutely. You're supposed to always work at a local level. I mean, what does Aristotle say politics is? Something like two or three get together and decide how they're going to live their life together.
Right.
I mean, if you got that at a local level, then you've got something. Mm-hmm. I've always been concerned about the future, in the sense that something big is going to happen sooner or later. And everybody knows it. And that's why even the arts know it, because they're making all these movies that are like destruction movies and towering infernos and you know, the end of the world. And because everybody kind of knows something's going to happen sooner or later. We can't continue the way we're going.
Right.
There is a trajectory and we know we're on it, and it just can't go on forever. Someone compared it to a ship out at sea that, you know, it's a big pleasure vote, but the pleasure's got to end sooner or later. It just can't keep going. So, okay, true. And those communities that have rallied and unified themselves, I think, are the ones that are going to be able to hold off the weirdness that may happen in that area. And they will leave them alone because they won't be easy targets. They won't be juicy, you know, places. They'll be like, hey, there's resistance here. Let's go someplace else.
Right.
I think that, to me, is very attractive. So you find these communities that are working to, you know, among themselves to overcome their differences and not let that division of the higher ups seep in and divide them, find themselves in a much better position for whatever it is. So I think in terms of a future reality, something going wrong, I like that idea very much. But I also like the idea that we should try to resist as much as possible, even at the highest levels when possible, so that it can be frustrated. The devil is ultimately the organizer. He's the big community organizer, right. You know. And so he's back there, and he's only can work on permission. So his permissions are limited. And if we can continue to fight him, his permissions, I think he probably wanted a whole lot more things done by now, but his permissions just, they just keep running out, and he keeps getting new ones, but they just haven't been as successful as he's expected, perhaps. I could be wrong on that, but it seems to me that he's behind schedule. Right. And so the longer we can resist him, the more we're able to, you know, get in the position where we're ready to fight him better. I suppose that's how I would propose it.
2012 came and went.
2012 came and went. Yeah.
Well, then, and with the craziness in...
You mean the Mayan and all that stuff?
Yeah. There's a great cartoon of that. I'll link it up here so people can see it, where the... it shows some Mayans sitting out, and one of them's got this big wheel where they wrote their calendars, and he said, oh, I stopped in 2012 because I ran out of space.
Yeah,
and said,
exactly.
That'll freak somebody out one day.
Well, you know, I really like those things, to be honest. I remember them coming around, and you kind of laugh, and you just think, I hope people will see when it's through how dumb it is to follow this stuff. But they follow it anyway, and after they're done, oh, I guess this was the wrong one, and they'll go find something else.
Rapture mania.
They'll go find something else.
It's funny with the rapture, too, that comes around, because that's actually an ancient heresy, that of Killism. It was an opinion in some fathers, and then later fathers that universally condemned it.
Yes.
And this whole idea that Christ is going to come, raise everyone and bring him for 1,000 years in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And things
as
like
if
that.
Christ coming again and raising you up, you'd want to stay here. I'm ready to go now. Let's go. You know,
exactly.
Let's not stay down here where it's all been destroyed. And I mean, with the new heavens and the new earth, they're going to happen. Why would you?
Exactly.
There's something about that. There's something about this 1,000-year thing that's strange. It keeps coming back.
Right.
And you know there's some other reason for it coming back that's not healthy.
My recent translation of Robert Bellarmine on Antichrist, which is book 3 of On the Roman Pontiff, it's somewhat abridged from that. But in there, he talks about the 1,000 years, and he says the 1,000 years is really just commenting from some of the fathers that it's really just figurative for basically, you know, the devil's reign in the age of the Gentiles, and that how he's going to try to tempt the church, destroy the church, so that the last age, basically, because 1,000 years could be understood as that it's an age that way, and so that it's the last age of the church where after the founding of the church by Christ, then the devil's working to tempt it, and so in that sense, he's loosed.
Yes, interesting. I've got to finish that book.
Yeah,
I will.
Exactly. So I guess with that, though, from the political sphere, we also have in the religious sphere great confusion, not just amongst traditional Catholics anymore, but also amongst those who are generally called the mainstream or Novus Ordo, or we got some conservative Catholics, where the Pope just seems to be causing greater and greater confusion when he speaks. And even Cardinal Mueller, not too long ago, said that the Pope should basically be putting everything he says and writes in front of the CDF before it goes out. And that's not so much of a, you know, people sometimes took it, oh, look, he's given a no-confidence vote to the Pope. But then again, in history, many popes did that very same thing. And because they recognized they were weak theologians, and so they gave it to the theologians to craft these things. Whereas Francis doesn't seem to be terribly interested in that. And so a lot of people are generally confused. So then, you know, many run to sedevacantism, for example. Also, so, well, it's obvious he must be a heretic then, because he's saying all these things that sound so crazy, or you can transpose quotes where Francis says something that's exactly opposed to what Alphonsus Liguori says or many others. And you know, in any possible way where Jimmy Akin and all possible manners of reasoning and all physicians couldn't come up with the explanation for it.
Exactly.
So what should Catholics do when it seems as if the Pope is on the same page with a lot of the... And I say seems as with, you know, as, because we don't know everything, and obviously there's a lot of room for doubt, but certainly with the environmental light show, Laudato Si, and so many things where... And you got the guy who's doing this whole light show on St. Peter's is a pagan who worships Jupiter. And the things like that just seems to defy explanation. How can the Pope do this? What can Catholics do when faced with these kind of things, not to mention various prevarications in the hierarchy?
Well, this is a very interesting problem to deal with. But before we go there, let me just answer or say one more thing about voting and politics.
Oh, sure.
There was one thing I forgot to say, and I think that just to make it clear for any listener is that I think today there's also the tendency to say we have to choose the lesser of two evils.
Right.
And you cannot take that principle. That is not, because you can never choose an evil that a good may come. And you have more than two choices. You can write in a candidate. Mm-hmm. So never use that principle like, oh, I'm choosing the lesser of two evils. No, don't do that. You must choose to the one who will lessen the evil. Keep that as your principle, not choose the lesser of two evils. Now, in regards to the Pope, well, this is not an easy thing to answer. And here's why. First of all, because he is our Father, at least visibly presented to be so. Was there a technical problem in his election? Is he validly elected? Did Pope Benedict really resign? These are difficult things. And you say to yourself, I mean, maybe this is true. But ultimately, the Church has presented him to us as our Father. And at least to some degree, he has been accepted as the Pope. So we can't go the sede vacantis route. But we could say maybe someday they may look into things and determine that he really wasn't our Pope. Right. But for us today, that's a dead end and that's a ditch, and you don't want to go down there. What you want to say is that, okay, he's our Father. And sometimes our fathers are a mess. But you know what? That's my dad. And I don't want to speak bad about my dad, even though he's doing some really bad stuff right now. And he's hurting the family terribly. And he's going to split us apart. And maybe he's going to actually take us down a cliff. But he is our dad. I can't change that. So I have to start there. So piety dictates that I had to be very careful about attacking my father. And this is where it gets really hard, because faith is more important than the Pope. So faith is higher. And this is something that we find the great conflict in, is that here I have a Pope who's attacking the faith of the Church. So what do I do? Well, we are free to analyze and criticize and contradict the sayings of our Father without touching his person. So St. Pius X would say, attack the error, not the person. Do the best you can to attack the error and not the person. Okay, now, in regards to the errors coming from this Pope, when he first got into office, my fellow priest and I, we looked on the internet as soon as possible, because we listen to books while we're eating, and it's not always easy to find books written by popes. So if you go back and look at John Paul II, there's hardly any books in audible form from John Paul II. There's a few. And then there's only one or two by Pope Benedict. But all of a sudden, within a couple of months, there were two available. And now I think there's up to 11 available on and by Pope Francis. So you know something's up when you saw that. You go, well, that's interesting in itself.
Right.
But they republished, or in audible form, the books by a Pope or Cardinal Bergoglio to an interview with some journalists and also with the Rabbi Skorka.
Right.
And so we listen to those, and right away you got a feel for who we're up against, what was going on, who is this man, and you get a feel for it. And then talking to people who live in South America who are objective in their thinking, I think, very well spoken, and they claim that he's a low-level liberation theologian, or low-level believer in liberation theology. So
he's not quite a Bachite, but he's in the same camp.
Yeah, he's not willing to cut off heads and go to war, but he's very soft in his approach, but yet Marxist in his leanings. Now, in his books, he spoke multiple times about how he saved our library of Marxism during the revolution down there. And he was proud about that. And he had a Marxist teacher in high school. But he kept saying, well, I'm not a Marxist. Now, in a Marxist way of thinking, he's actually professing that he is a Marxist. That's a sort of double speak. Take it or leave it, What he's saying is that I believe in this sort of thinking. That's why I preserve that stuff. I mean, just translate what he said to this. Oh, yeah, I had a Nazi teacher, and he was really nice, but I'm not a Nazi. No one would ever say that.
Right.
Or how about this? I have a friend who had a Nazi library, and I saved his Nazi library for him during the revolution. And, you know, no one would brag about saving a Nazi library. He's bragging about it because he knows this is accepted and it's kind of the modus of operandi today. Now, I bring all that up only because it seems that one could easily understand the Pope more easily or readily in looking at him under the Marxist way of thinking. That he is a dialectician, that he will present things in dialectical manners. So what I mean is that one day he may speak something that seems true and good. You know, there's a devil and he's doing this, and wow, the Pope spoke on that devil today, and the Pope will say this, and it'll sound just so true. Next day he'll get up and say something totally contrary and different, and it'll cause that stirring up that he's looking for. He says it over and over again, stir things up, go home and stir things up, cause confusion and don't be afraid. You know, we got to get things going. That's a Marxist. So with, you know, without...
Talk about Leo, make a mess.
Make a mess. Not to necessarily label, because I'm not sure I'm qualified to put an exact label and say this man is, but it would seem from all the data that we have more or less a Marxist-leaning Pope. And so what you have then is someone who's not wed to truth, but wed to getting something done in a certain way. So he's not afraid to pit people against each other.
Right.
Now, this is just a proposal. And I mean, this is dangerous, but it's true in a way. There's something like this is going on. Let's just say you're a cardinal and your job is to warn the Pope and to show him your concerns for the church. So this family on this synod is coming up and you're a group of cardinals and you decide we're going to write a letter. So you write a letter to the Pope. Now, he gets the letter and now he can, you know, he's the Pope. He can take that letter and do what he wants with it. And so maybe, you know, he doesn't release it in the exact form it came. He releases it and all of a sudden the cardinals are shamefaced. See, now he's got them in a position in which they're not going to do that again.
Right.
I'm not doing that again. Look what happened last time. Guess what? That was a dialectic. I just got you to do what I wanted you to do. Mm-hmm. Now I'm in a higher position than, and I got you not to heal and do old-fashioned cardinal-like things. Mm-hmm. You're not going to do that. So see, he uses what they thought was a good thing, he actually can use it and turn it and use it in a dialectical manner to get mm-hmm. him more power. And I think that is more like probably what's going on. There's something like that going on in the church all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're not seeing people who are in love with the church that are they're not in love with truth. They're aiming at this future reality they've got in their mind. Mm-hmm. So when the communists started in 1917, they were looking at this future reality of future workers' paradise.
Right.
And so they didn't mind all the destruction that was going on in their presence. Mm-hmm. And so these guys, they don't mind seeing people leave the church. They don't mind all this stuff going on. They want to bring about a future reality that's going to require a leveling, including the papacy. So, and that's another way to view it. This Pope is constantly leveling the papacy almost at every turn he can. I'm not in the papal palace anymore. I'm not going to wear papal garments anymore. I'm not going to do papal things anymore.
Even is suffering the appearance of hypocrisy because I'm not going to live in the papal apartments. Or we've got to do things for the poor, yet he's spending millions of euros to renovate this building and make it so he can live there.
Exactly. And once again, it's all this dialectical thing, I think. That's what that's a fancy word, but it just means I'm going to use two opposites to try to bring back another reality.
That Hegelian dialect.
Hegelian dialect.
We propose a thesis, then we're going to propose its antithesis, and then out of that, we get the solution, or as people like to put it today, truth is in the middle.
Truth is in, or you know, you get another dialectic going until you finally reach a level where it's purified.
Which is why, and it's interesting when you look at various maneuvers that Francis has made with, say, the Society of Pius X, and people like Father Zusseldorf have mused, you know, as ironic as it is, Francis might be the person to reconcile them. And you just have to stop and say, well, how does that work? You know, is that another form of the dialectic?
I think it is. And I think that even him giving the society faculties to hear confessions was a dialectic, mm-hmm. because it did cause confusion.
Right.
Because it broke with canon law and norm. Mm-hmm. So the bishops are kind of stuck. Here they've just decreed, maybe in some dioceses, I know, they decreed you couldn't go to the society. Now all of a sudden they can go to the society.
Right.
Or if I got a priest in the diocese now that can hear confessions, but he's got no faculties to say mass, does this make any sense? And then let's say the society priest does something wrong in the confession, or
right.
and who's responsible for him? All these little things start to swirl, because you're like, well, what do I do? Mm-hmm. You know, it was a nice move, but was that the proper move?
Right.
It doesn't matter. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I want to cause. And now I always say this, and I think that I should be careful, but I think there's some truth to it, and it's dangerous. But I think that this Pope wouldn't mind you hating him. He wouldn't mind that. That's part of the dialectic.
Somebody said to the Italian journalist Antonio Socci. Socci actually wrote a book arguing that Francis is not the real Pope and Benedict is.
Yeah.
He said, Benedict e lo non è Francesco. And it's sold out in its first printing, actually. And I got a copy of the book. I thought some of his arguments were weak. Some of his arguments weren't too bad. But then he just wrote another book seriously attacking Bergoglio, and in some articles claiming Bergoglio is putting himself in the place of God. And Francis wrote him a letter thanking him for the criticism. You know, just, you know, on the one hand, you could take that to those who say when you criticize the Pope, you're evil, you can't do this. Well, look, the Pope wants this kind of criticism. I'd never say the stuff he's saying, and look at that. But on the other hand, what else is going on there?
Yeah.
There's something very interesting.
Yeah, I honestly think he would want you, I think he wants you to hate him. Mm-hmm. As weird as that may sound, and therefore we should not hate him at all.
Right.
We should want him to die a happy death, maybe sooner than later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just that, because he is hurting the church. Mm-hmm. And if you read Psalm 108, verse 8, I think it is, it says, may his days be few and his bishopric be given to another. That is a prayer of the church. Mm-hmm. It's said every Saturday in Nolan, mm-hmm. in the Latin Breviary.
Right.
And so you're praying that if someone is in a position of episcopacy and is not worthy, may his days be short and his episcopate be given to another. Mm-hmm. But we want him to die a happy death. We don't hate him. We don't want him to go to hell. We would hate that. We want him to be saved and to see the error of his ways. But will he? I mean, does he understand what he's doing? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's another...
I hope not.
There's another theory that you can... That I think works. There's a couple... And one of them would be that back in the 1950s, first of all, stepping back a little, Our Lady did say World War II would be a chastisement. I sincerely believe that. I think many people are going down the wrong track in saying pre and post Vatican II. I think it's pre and post World War II. I think World War II is what was the impetus and the catalyst to make Vatican II possible and to work so well. Yeah. If it weren't for World War II, Vatican II would have never worked. So you have that World War II. But right after World War II, you got Teilhard de Chardin rising up and gaining popularity and support. Mm-hmm. And now, Teilhard proposes a different Christ, a cosmic Christ. This is the Christ that Bergoglio and others are working with. They're working on a different model, a different ideal, a different foundation than we are.
You can see that, and I'm not sure if you actually... if you've ever seen this before, but one of Francis's favorite he's a very big devotee of modern art, surprise, and one of his favorite pictures is the white crucifixion of Chagall.
I think and I saw that. It made me
yeah,
sick.
Yes, I've got it right here.
Yes, I've seen that before.
Yeah. So at the very there we go. And so it's and I'll put a picture of it in the webpage so that you can see it as you're listening to the recording. But it's a very interesting image, very disturbing. It was done by a Jew. And you can understand how a Jew will have an interesting perspective on, obviously, on Christ. But they paint Christ as a Hasid. And they show all around it, you know, these interesting proportions. Actually, they're using techniques from, you know, from more in the Renaissance, even though it's very surrealistic in many ways. But it shows different pictures of persecution of Jews in the background, and it's kind of linking Christ as the root for all their persecution. And then it says at the top, where normally, obviously, in a Latin crucifix, you have an IHS. Well, it has the INRI, but they have INRI with the Hebrew underneath it, which spells out Imak Shechmo Vezrikho. May his name and memory be blotted out.
Wow.
And that's from, and that's, now, probably Pope Francis doesn't know that, I'm sure. Wow. As far as I know, he's not much of a linguist, but nevertheless, you know, nobody's pointed out to him this is a very problematic painting.
It's a blasphemous painting.
It is. So
that's pure out blasphemy.
Yeah. And that's what they say in the Talmud whenever Jesus' name is mentioned.
And that's why the popes had it burned when they discovered what it was. They thought it was innocent. In commentary, when they discovered that our Lord was in a vat of this and our lady in that, they said, burn that book everywhere you can find it. And of course, they've been criticized for that ever since. Yeah. Innocent the Third. I think it was.
Right, yes, it was.
Yeah.
And St. Dominic also, and because the Dominicans learned Hebrew, and they pioneered the Hebrew science in Europe, and they came up with all these things. And discovering that, and plus what they said about Our Lady, it's very shocking, actually, at the time. And obviously, you can't tag every single Jew with that today.
No, of course not. I
have no idea about
it. No, of course not.
Just so the listener knows, you know, we're not anti-Semitic, but you do have to point out the real errors.
Yeah, not at all.
And
no.
So,
there's some wonderful Jewish converts that are tremendous people.
Right. You know, I'm Jewish heritage as well.
That's right. You told me that once. That's right.
That's right. So it's interesting too. Some other things, like you see the manifestations of things that Pope Francis does. So, for example, obviously he goes to Latin America and they give him this crucifix made by a liberation.
And he smiles. Happy to get it.
And it's interesting. It shows how the papal message gets filtered. You saw this under John Paul II to a certain extent, but under Francis, it's clear where the Catholic News and World Report had to invent this phony story that he was mad about it because they knew most Americans would freak out at the sight of the Pope wearing this communist crucifix.
But thank God for the filming.
I know.
Because we could watch the whole
thing. And the Puzzle Lombardi even clarified, no, he was very pleased. He wore it. I mean, all these things kind of show us where his leanings are. And actually, my father always said, if you want to know what a person's about, don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do.
Yes.
So watching the things that Francis does, and we should talk about these reform to canon law last year. And a number of canonists I know have commented, and I know you're not a canonist, but canonists that I've known, as well as people I know personally who work as advocates in tribunals and whatnot, they've related how, just canonically, it's a disaster. It doesn't make any sense, and he introduces these novelties, such as the parties involved both mutually feel that they did not get it.
Exactly.
No court of law would take what two witnesses feel at the present as a witness to what was going on at the time of it, where certain things under investigation. But it puts that it's just as much weight as evidence.
Which, of course, flows from modernism, that interior upwelling and feeling and yikes.
Yeah, precisely. And so, is there anything else you've read on that it gives you cause for concern?
No, I think what got me concerned is what Cardinal Burke spoke about, that, you know, that second instance where someone is checking.
Right.
Even if the check is, so to speak, rubber stamped, you know someone's going to look it over, so you're more reluctant to cut corners and, you know, do anything shady. Always knowing that this is going to go through a second court makes you keep your I's dotted and your T's crossed.
Right.
And it's been proven that when that was done, put into place, it was to stop abuses, and it did. It brought a lot of abuses to an end back in the 80s when Pope John Paul II put it into place. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is an opening Pandora's box. But in a way, it's already in place anyway. Marriage has not been valued properly anyway. Father Hardin once said, before he died, he was saying that the church will never undergo reform until the sacrament of marriage is reformed and annulments are stopped. I don't think it was quite as universal as that, but it was close. I don't have an exact quote, but he was saying that basically marriage is the symbol of the church.
Right.
And if you don't have this right, then the foundation stones are going to not be in place and the whole thing's going to be constantly in uproar. Mm-hmm. So if you want to upset the church, upset marriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we are in this huge crisis.
Right.
You know we're at a cusp of something big because of those two family synods. We've reached the level of marriage now. We're fiddling now with this fundamental sacrament that is a manifestation of Christ's love for his church. You know, what happens when people split away from the church? They fall away from marriage right away.
Right.
And all the schismatics fell away from marriage.
Right.
They couldn't handle it. There's a couple divorces allowed at least, you know, the best in the Eastern Orthodox.
Right.
It's just, where does the Catholic maintain the line? We don't allow divorce. We don't allow this, you know. And now we've got, so to speak, Catholic divorce in the annulment process.
Right. As we wait the exhortation of desolation.
As we, yes, after Easter. God right. save us, I'm afraid. I'm afraid.
Fortunately, he will, but probably not as fast as we should hope.
We should not be surprised at what will ever will be said. We should not be surprised. God's allowing a lot right now.
Right.
And we should just maintain our faith and not worry. And say, okay, this is just one more step closer to the time in which it's all going to be transformed.
Right. Especially if Perow's blogs, God forbid, Facebook, which I call the poison spring of all heresy and sins against charity. And it has so many different problems. But at the same time, you peruse, you know, these places and you see what traditional Catholics or traditional Catholic laity are saying, primarily. And you see there's not just that there's a lot of confusion. There's also, there is actually a lot of, not even so much anger as being miffed, and then people, you know, criticize and attack the Pope, and then criticize and attack each other. And then, so you hear a lot of confessions. You know, and traditional Catholics, in my opinion, suffer actually from a form of, you know, and I'm a traditional Catholic. I've been in the novitiate, I don't know how many years. I've been traditional probably for the last 16 years. But
thank God.
But it's not something that I am so smart that I saw. God gave me the grace, and he gave me the right occasions, and he made the right doors, and I eventually came to it. But it seems to me a lot of trads I've come across have this idea that they're so smart. They have the tradition because they're so smart and they found it. It's almost like a certain Gnosticism. We have the secret knowledge. We know what the tradition is, and these people don't, and they're heretics. And the Pope is a heretic, all these things. People turn around and argue, you know, with each other. And they, you know, where are most trads at, given the kind of confessions you've heard? You know, or is there trads, you know, they're trying to be the paragon. You see every trad's an expert. This one's an expert in modesty. This one, you know, so she's the guru on modesty, and she tells you what, and really you're just looking at a dress code from the 1950s. It's not what historically was necessarily
right.
Modest. And then this one's a guru on these issues and traditionals and whatnot. Where are trad's lives in terms of confession?
Well, in my life, they oftentimes aren't bringing those things to me. So I don't really know the answer to that.
Well, just in terms of their general personal life on the other side, the other face from the one they're showing on Facebook and the blogs.
Right. I think that what I find is that usually I'm helping them unravel knots of some kind in their life and trying to show them the way out. Because when you are a missionary, you only get, if you're lucky, maybe 20 minutes with somebody. And that's a long time in confession.
Right.
And oftentimes I don't think you ever reach that level where you're dealing with this. You hear about them. You hear about others complaining about these people who are experts. And I have run into them occasionally, but I really don't bump up against them a lot. And also, I think one of the reasons is because when you are presenting, hopefully, a mission, it's well organized. Long thought has gone into it, and it's hopefully more or less tight. And when they see that, they know there's no conversion for you and there's no wiggle room. So they don't try to convince you of their way. They let you go through and then you're gone, and then they go back to their old ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I do know, I have run across people that have this problem that you're mentioning. And one of them is they've read a few books and they become all of a sudden experts. And I don't blame them in one way. You feel sorry for them because we're living in a time where there's a vacuum of authority and proper teaching. So what ends up happening is that they'll get multiple opinions from different priests, and they'll hear all these things, and they'll say, well, I guess I got to go figure it out on my own. And then they look into it and they figure it out, and then they know. And from that point on, someone can come along that's well-informed and explain to them why they're wrong. They just won't listen. I mean, I've had arguments with people until I'm blue in the face, it almost seems, and they just won't listen. You're like giving them the fathers, you're giving them the doctors, you're giving them the tradition, you're giving them all kinds of reasons why this doesn't work. They don't care. And then you, then one of the deadly things you should never do, but you end up doing it. I don't know why, because we're human. We say, you know, I went to all these years in seminary. Oh, that makes you the expert. Right. And they don't understand what it takes to right. get to the level where you're at. How much time and struggle and blood, sweat and tears it is to understand how you come to these theological conclusions. And by all means, I too have much to grow on. But to come across a layman who's become this self-proclaimed expert on this this or that dogma or doctrine or something, it can be frustrating to see that. And then what happens to those poor people is that the priest tries to lead them, and they just, they'll determine what they like. They become, so to speak, almost, you know, safe. I would use the word safe, I suppose, cafeteria Catholics, where they're picking and choosing what they like, what Father's saying, but they haven't violated, you know, but they're the law, like they haven't, like the bad cafeteria Catholics who are like right. picking and choosing dogmas. They still believe in the dogma, but they're the dogmas of the church, but they're still fighting Father on these issues that he has a right to lead them on. You know, holy orders, the priest's soul is reordered to be another Christ. And then he's placed in the order of God in his church. And then he is to establish order in the world the best he can. You know, in his parish, in his the families underneath him. But people are unwilling to cooperate with his ordering. Now, once again, can you blame them? A lot of these priests are sources of disorder.
Right.
So we're just living in a time in which, if we could put it like this, the prophecies of Isaiah and Zacharias are coming true, where it says, and God left them all, each to go his own way. And this is the scary part, is that these poor people are, as it were, left alone to go their own way. And they shouldn't do it. Right. They should resist that and try to put themselves under the direction of the priest at the pulpit, leading the parish. And even if they don't like it, as long as it's not sinful, go along and God will bless you. So you don't make yourself an expert on modesty. You know, modesty, like you've pointed out already, is got some relativity to it. Do we want to go back to the 19th century modesty? Where they have various petticoats on and all kinds of stuff, and it's thick, and there's nothing but the neck seen and the hands. I mean, they're very beautiful, but I don't see anybody going back to that modesty.
Right.
I've seen women wearing all sorts of clothing, dress and everything, covered over, but it's so tight or thin, you can see practically right through it sometimes, or you can see the shape of their body. But by modern standards, they're modest. You know, and I don't agree with that, but I'm just trying to say, hey, she's got a long dress on, she's covered, but yet her body is obviously, I can right. see the shape. Where you see some women, maybe the dress is over the knees, they're very well dressed, they're modest, I like it. It's like, that's very nice. But other women would say, hey, that's not down to the ankles, you're not modest.
Right.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's going too far.
Mm-hmm.
So you're making yourself a judge where you don't have a right.
Mm-hmm.
So St. Augustine said it best. In essential matters, unity. In non-essential matters, liberty. In all things, charity.
Right. Charity being the one that's missing most of the time.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, too, you brought up the right point of why you get the case of the angry trad, the know-it-all trad, the type of trad, the ones that turn people away from tradition. Well, I don't want to be like these people. Or the ones that anger trads in and try to, you know, deal with this poison spring in the internet of all these people going under. Generally the minority, because there's a good number of trads are just kind of they're neither the angry trad nor the know-it-all trad. They're just trying to get through, and they don't necessarily always measure up to tradition, but they're trying, and they're not very presumptive. So it seems to be the majority that nobody ever hears from.
Yes.
But with the others, you know, and everyone is in this disorder in the traditional movement, it seems, because of the fact that for so many years, you know, in some places until Summorum Pontificum and others not quite that long, there's basically the lepers of the church. The hierarchy doesn't want them around. They'd rather they just went away
because
it's a blemish on the whole Vatican II restoration, and quote unquote, sneer quotes, I'll put it. Because we don't want these people around. So because they haven't had episcopal guidance from bishops, who at the very least be very fatherly and try to direct them, you know, spiritually.
Exactly.
They haven't had that, or even priests in many cases, too. So you have it reminds me actually what happened in the English mission under Elizabeth, where you had the Marian priests, the priests that had been made since Queen Mary's time, the secular clergy, and the Jesuits got in a row over things. And right in the same time, that question of efficacious grace comes up with Banyas and Molina, and that's following through into Louvain, it's following through the Dewey College, it's following through the secular clergy, and now this attitude that the Jesuits are trying to control everything. They're even picking up the Protestant propaganda. The Jesuits want to control everything. And so they get into fights over it, and there's no bishop to settle it.
Yeah.
And then when they go to Rome, and then the Pope's like, well, we don't want to put a bishop who's not productive and has to be supported by others. So once you get an archpriest who doesn't have any power to do anything, but you know, and it doesn't solve anything, creates 10 times more problems. But so, and that's the thing, you see the English mission largely collapses in that way. I mean, people still go there, but there's no longer a unity and unified.
Same with the Chinese mission. You know, they got in arguments, and it ended up crushing the whole thing. They just didn't have that guidance on architecture, on language, on. They were all trying and bitterly fighting each other.
Chinese rights question and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like so many of these things, just because the Christ established the bishops for a reason. And we like to mock the bishops now because, and it's so easy, and I've done it before too. And it's just so easy. One, it's just like criticizing a politician at this point. And
yeah.
And like the quoted phrase of St. John Chrysostom, the road to hell is paved with the skulls of bishops.
Yes.
But he said that because there's so many concerns and cares for a bishop that if he doesn't devote himself to the salvation of his people, that he could be damned. He wasn't speaking so much on bad bishops for whom it was manifest. But see, and because we're so used to bishops covering up pedophiles and moving people around doing these bad things, we've gotten accustomed to just slamming the bishop whenever anything bad goes on.
And we have examples of that on the internet too, where these people are, like Cardinal Dolan, showing him always in the most unfavorable position and light possible to really bring down his person, which I think is a huge mistake. I mean, I do not like what he's saying and doing, but on the same token, keep the personal jabs and pictures and things out of it. Show what he's doing wrong, simply saying, this is what he said, this is why this is wrong, and leave it at that. Don't attack his person. They're constantly doing that. Like Church Militant is an example. Yes. Constantly. It's, oh my goodness. I think that is so unhealthy.
Right.
It's so impious. It's against piety to attack in that way. They are our fathers. You know, it's like attacking your own dad. Mm-hmm.
So in the face of all these dangers, both in the temporal sword as well as in the spiritual sword, where everything just seems to be turned against anyone who really wants to love Christ and get to heaven, what can we do as laity to neither look right nor left, as it says in Deuteronomy, and to not, you know, get sidetracked? How do we have a spirituality? You've preached in missions on angelic spirituality. How can the faithful, especially traditionalist faithful who are in some of these camps you talked about, how can they get this angelic spirituality?
Well, one of the things I think is so, so important is to realize we have what it takes to endure this moment. God never leaves us abandoned. He always gives us what we need, and he often provides it well ahead of time. And so I think if you look, whenever there's a revolution, you look at the beginning of that revolution, you'll find the solutions already for how to endure to the very end present, either by way of prophecy or by typology or even church teaching. But so this revolution, we can say, at least started to burst out during the Renaissance. And if you look at that time, you'll find prophets like St. Francis of Paola, or you'll find St. Nicholas of Flue, and you'll look at what they say. And they say, there's going to come a time and it's going to look like this. This is the time he spoke of. It fits perfectly. And then what does he say to do? Stick with what your fathers told you from long ago. Stay the course. Stay on that road and you'll be saved. So you think, okay, there's the solution. Stay the course of what we've always done. And that's exactly the principle of the revolution that they hold the most. You can do whatever you want. But don't you dare do what they used to do.
Right. We can never go back.
They can never go back.
Anything Vatican II, they always say that. We can never go back.
We can never go back. Do whatever you want, but don't do this. So I always tell people, like, when it comes to saying Mass in the Novus Ordo, you can do just about anything you want. But the minute you start to hold your fingers together, as they did in the old days, bang, you're in trouble.
Right.
I know a priest that was in a diocese close to the eastern coast. I heard this from his pastor. There's a young priest there, very zealous, and his pastor told me that the vicar of priests of the diocese drove 100 and so miles just to come and see because he heard that this young priest was holding his fingers together. Meanwhile, there's cases of pedophilia, all kinds of things going on in the diocese. Those didn't matter. What mattered was this young priest had the gall to hold his fingers together. And I'm going to come correct him. And the pastor sent that man packing. Get out of here. He's under my care, not yours. So he was tough enough and old enough to kick him out and not even let him stick around very long.
Right.
But that just shows you, that's the truth. As long as you don't do what you used to do, you can do whatever you want. And so that means that's the solution. The solution is what we used to do. So if you look back, you find great peace. I think Psalm 76 is the one to look at as well, used for Friday Night Compline. It says in there that he's disturbed. He's upset because it seems, this is why this is such a powerful psalm, because it seems the way of the Lord has changed. It would seem. So you look at the church today and you look what's going on and you would say, it seems like the way of the Lord has changed. And I'm upset. I'm disturbed. My soul's not at peace. What am I supposed to do? And it says in there, I will look back on all the wonders of the Lord and find out what he used to do. And from there, he finds his way. So he looked back, and that's exactly what the Maccabees did in their time of crisis too. So you start looking around and you find types. What did God do in the old days? We find these types to prepare us for what we're supposed to do in these times. So at the end of an age and a coming of Christ, you have the Maccabees. So one of the most sane things you can do during this time is to pull out the Maccabees and meditate upon it. Mm. Know those books, study them, and you'll find the solutions over and over, stated in many different ways, what we're supposed to be doing now. And for example, one of them is love of the priesthood. It was priests that saved the day.
Right.
And second of all, they loved family life. It was one family that saved the nation. Mm-hmm. One good family that sticks together can save the nation. We're back to your political, the small, family united organizations, locally united, can save the whole country. I mean, this is it. But you know, you'll also look back and you'll find these types and you can cling on to them. And you can say, these types or persons, their places, their things that really existed, and things happened to them in a certain way that's kind of odd for their own time. But that God did that to them so that we could see it and say, what they did, we need to do in a bigger way. So, you know, you look at Spain as a good example.
Right.
How Spain cleaned house and finally found unity. They tried dialoguing with the Muslims. They said, you could live in Granada after they conquered them. You can live here and you can have your mosques. And they tried to get along, but it wasn't very long before they realized, no, dialogue and working with these people is impossible. Get out. And they got him out.
Right.
And that's what we had. That's a type. The track we're on with dialoguing with Muslims is a complete dead end. And it's been proven to be so.
Right.
Even with good-willed monarchs, giving them the benefit of the doubt, giving them much leeway to work, doesn't work. It won't work. It's a dead end. So looking back gives you sanity. Studying the lives of the saints, you find these types. And I hold that Joan of Arc is a type, a huge type for us. And she had to pass through a passion. And we're in it now. We're in the passion. So you can't run away. You've got to stick the course. And you've got to endure the trial. And it'll feel like you're all alone, just like Joan. It'll feel like you're surrounded by evil, just like Joan was in prison with these evil men trying to deflower her. They were unsuccessful because she maintained course in her prayer. You have to have recourse to St. Michael. She had St. Michael.
Right.
You have to have, abandonment to God and realize, you know, when she was asked questions, she never repeated herself. She said, look, I already talked about that. Tradition. Stick with tradition. It'll save you. You need the cross. It was the cross that ultimately kept her in place on the burning at the stake. All these things kind of play in and show you this is what it's about. You stay the course in these ways. Joan could do it. We can do it. St. Lydwin is another one. Here's a girl that's on her bed for 38 years. Can't eat, can't drink, can't sleep. She's suffering everything under the sun. She's showing what the church in a passion looks like. She's paralyzed. Her eyes are blinded. She can hardly talk. Her hands are paralyzed almost. She has barely use of one hand. You know, there it is. The church seemingly right now is paralyzed. The real church, she's not speaking. She's not allowed to speak. Everything she says is used against her, just like Joan.
Right.
So we see that, and it gives you comfort. They endured it, and they survived. Mm-hmm. We can endure it, and we will survive. So when Lightwin died, her body returned to a beautiful young 17-year-old girl. And she was, that's what we're going to go, that's what's going to happen to us. Joan, after she died, her heart did not burn, and the rehabilitation rejuvenated all her works and life and said she was 100% okay. Nothing wrong with Joan.
What about Savonarola?
I just reread a book on Savonarola, now that you bring that up, and I think he's a very important figure for our time. I just reread the book on him. It was translated from somebody over in Europe, and I did read Michael Davies' article from Latin Mass Magazine some years ago. I find Savonarola a very important figure for our time, but not for reasons that Michael Davies might have. I think he's an example of what not to do.
Right.
I do think that.
Because he got politically involved in trying to unseat the Pope by bringing the French in.
He got out of his bounds. I think if you can stay within your bounds and work within your circle, you're going to be all right. He was doing a great job of working within his circle.
Right.
He was reforming his monasteries. He was fighting the Medici. And
he got Botticelli is transferring from the pagan admirer painting religious works.
And he got him to burn some of his pictures, I think, even. Or people were burning various paintings. And they're like, hey, no, he was right. These are wicked. And Savonarola was respected by Philip Neri and others for that reason. Right. Loved by them.
Well, I think I first heard this is Michael Davies, and I did find the source for it, which actually was in the canonization documents of Philip Neri, that the Dominicans were fearful when there was a question whether they should condemn all of Savonarola's works. And then, so the Dominicans asked Philip Neri to come pray with them at the Minerva in Rome, and they did. And then Philip Neri stopped, and he had this lighting
ecstasy.
He just said, "Friends," and he stopped for a few minutes, and then he said, "Our prayers have been answered." And then the condemnation never came down.
That's right, and I think that many people enjoyed reading his works, and I think that Paul the IV was it?
Yes.
During that time, he wanted them condemned, and then
Paul
it came
the fourth
out.
Is
okay.
An interesting Pope. Of course, the Sedevacantists quote him a lot because he wrote Cum Ex Apostolicis Officio. But Paul the IV is one of these guys that very pious and zealous, but heresies everywhere and heretics are everywhere.
Kafara.
Well, he was the one when we talked earlier off the mic on about Cardinal Poole.
Yes.
He was an English cardinal, very holy cardinal, mistaken in a couple points, but when Trent was done, he accepted every single thing that Trent put down. But Kafara, when he was in the running for Pope, Kafara said, "You can't elect him because he's a heretic," as well as Cardinal Monroney, right? And so it sidetracked the whole thing, and then they told Cardinal Poole he wasn't going to be chosen, so he said, "Well, God has no need of this ass." He was just a very holy man, suffered through all kinds of things, went back to England, suffered in England trying to help restore the faith under Queen Mary. Very holy guy, but on the other hand, Kafara was just convinced he was a heretic, so
yes,
he was willing to risk schism again in England, and emboldening the heretics in England by wanting Poole recalled and all his acts undone, even though they would have undone this massive restoration of the church, which shows how well Poole did, and that not a single Marian bishop went with Elizabeth when Elizabeth came after the Christmas walkout of the Christmas mass there. None of them. It shows that how well Poole was working on reforming the church in England after all of that would have happened under Henry and Edward. It's amazing. And so, but Kafara was convinced he was a heretic. He took Monroney, a good associate of Poole's, threw him in prison, even though Monroney protested that he believed whatever the Catholic Church believed and was signed everything. Kafara didn't believe, threw him in prison. And then a bunch of other people, too. He had in prison, he with these harsh penalties, and he put so many books on the index, declared that if a Protestant had even edited one line of work from Cicero, you couldn't read the whole work. And this puts the Jesuits in Germany, where you have a lot of learned individuals in a bind where they have to, for their schooling, to deal with these works. And the only decent editions were done by Protestants or done by Ogolampadius or something. And so it was a good work. There's nothing wrong with it. But
it's unsavory.
Was Lutheran, so it's unsavory.
It's unsavory.
So he had this problem. And then, so even St. Peter Canisius is writing back. It's a pious Paul the IV. He is just, so then Savonarola, he criticized the papacy. Yep. He said Alexander VI is no pope, that he can't excommunicate. It was his opinion that even Julius II confirmed that someone who gained as a simoniac and sold excommunications, that the excommunication would not be valid. Right? Julius II actually agreed with that opinion.
Julius II was a stellar pope.
Somewhat.
Good heavens.
So it's but he still looked at that, you know, and he wasn't so quick to condemn, you know, the legacy of Savonarola, even though he was only about a year after that.
Yes.
But nevertheless, you see all these things, and so Paul IV, just in case I die before I can kill Manroni and pull in a heresy trap, I'm going to make sure they never get elected, and that's where you get cum ex apostolicis officio.
Wow.
You know, but still, even there, it still abides by boundaries, where he says a pope prior to his election. So after he's elected, you can no longer ask this question.
Exactly.
And they always ignore that part.
Yes.
And it just
he wanted to get rid of Savonarola, and he admitted there was nothing he could do.
Yeah.
I think he admitted that Savonarola was fine.
Yeah.
And I think that there was, like, Isabella and others, I think, were reading Savonarola and liked him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his writings aren't so bad. I think it was just that he crossed that boundaries, couple boundaries, in getting political in the local state, mm-hmm. and then second of all, in going... trying to get the leaders of Europe to dethrone the Pope by getting a council together.
Right.
Now, I don't know about you, if you heard of this book, I recommend it. It's by G.J. Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
If you like G.J. Meyer, have you ever heard of him?
I haven't, actually.
Interesting historian. He wrote a book on the Tudors, which we found to be excellent. And he wrote a book on World War I, mm-hmm. which is amazing. It's the best one I've heard so far. We listened to it in the refectory, but... the one that's most amazing is his book on the Borgias.
Mm.
He's a very good historian. That's why I recommend him. If you get a chance, please.
I'll link it up when I find it.
Do listen to him, because he proves that many of the things with the Borgias are not well-founded.
Right.
And even Savonarola was off track and some of his accusations. And so it was like Savonarola was way outside of his boundaries in what he was doing there.
But personally, there was a Jesuit named Derues who showed, like, one of the most famous incidents was the Banquet of Chestnuts, and he showed how that was completely
exactly
malicious.
That's one of them. And it's proven to be false. Mm-hmm. And it's also proven that Borgia didn't fight people who were against him when they attacked him. He didn't care. And he probably wrote him thank you letters.
Right.
You know, and so all these guys that hated him were writing all these vindictive little pamphlets, and no one was there to counteract them. And the printing press was just working, and it was all...
Exactly.
And so everybody's reading...
Colony.
Yeah, and now we're like reading them, and it's accepted.
Yeah.
You know, G.J. Meyer even goes to Pasteur in his History of the Popes. He says he gives no foundation for some of these things. He says, sadly, even Pasteur, who's so reliable, says these things without foundation. It's sad.
It's just so fixed there. But even if all that, even if the worst was true...
He was a bad pope.
He was a bad pope.
At the end, especially.
Yes, but even if the worst was true all throughout, even up to the Banquet of Chestnuts and all that other nonsense, well, even if that was, God still resurrects good out of the evil.
Yeah.
Because you look at him, his grandson is St. Francis.
Exactly. But see, they even claim some... G.J. Meyer makes the point that he thinks that it's unfounded that he had any children at all.
Oh, really?
And he points out how impossible it would be for him to have had those children by this woman. Mm-hmm. She would have had been going here, there, and everywhere trying to make it possible. Mm-hmm. And he's saying that part of the problem is the patronymic and the way they did the names. And that he said it's a disaster, the genealogy, and everybody's assuming something. And he proves, at least he proves that it's not what you think. But he still suffered terribly from nepotism. That obviously was his besetting fault.
Right. As many popes did, too.
And Cesare is his huge lacuna in his prudence, and that's what caused him his downfall.
Right.
And, of course, Lucretia has been resurrected and shown to be actually a pretty good woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the poisoner.
Right.
But I loved what he said about the poison of the Borgias. He says, after you read all these statements about the Borgias, their poisoning was so effective, they could poison anybody in any manner they wanted. It could take place immediately. It could take place over months. It could take place over years. It was so plastic by the time they were done with their ability to poison people. They could poison anybody any way they wanted. In other words, it's just garbage.
Right.
You know, exactly. They didn't poison all these people.
Couldn't have.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So we've mentioned a couple of times the Muslims. And, of course, recently we just saw the suicide bombing in Brussels at the airport there. So Yeah, the Muslim immigration starts into Europe largely in the 70s. It'd been going on a little bits, but then there's a large wave of it in the 70s, and by and large, they assimilated. It's largely, you know, people of secular Islam from decent families, and they largely assimilated and became just kind of culturally, you know, European and soft on Islam. But then the next few generations of this Islamic immigration in Europe get more radicalized. The jobs start going down, the unemployment increases, and increasingly they're ghettoized. So in these first and second generation Islamic immigrants, now you're there at this creation of this Islamic culture. So, and then of course in this country you're seeing the same thing in many places. Not all, but in certainly like Detroit becomes a big one, and then they start pushing, we want all crucifixes gone out of these buildings because it offends us. You can't, you know, eat pork. We don't want you having pork. So like in Paris, they try to ban this pork fair. We don't want a pork fair going on. And then, you know, so now they're putting, and then they stretch the modern liberal notions of tolerance that they've been pushing, because they, you know, it's like the narratives are conflicting with each other. They don't know what to do. And so they're just like, all right, we'll do what they want, because we can't be mean to immigrants, of course. And now perhaps
we're seeing, multiculturalism.
Yeah, that's right. Now perhaps we're seeing the fruit of it. But then the response, at least in American politics, is always, we need a bomb, more bombing, more bombing, more bombing. Go over there. And that obviously hasn't done anything. Firstly, the people we're bombing are largely, you know, generally secular Muslims. I mean, they might support their own team, but on the other hand, they don't really know that much about it. Most of them are literate. They don't really care so much except about eating and feeding their kids and you know, living with their wives, and that's really all they particularly care about. And then, you know, the bomb goes off in their house or something. And so then, you know, you kind of create this next generation of radicals. But it seems to me they want to, at least on the government side, they want to create that, because then you have the fodder for geopolitical change. Why else is Obama supporting ISIS, basically, against Assad? I mean, it can't be ignored. There's reams of documentation that show that ISIS has, at the very least, been allowed to form and do what it does by our intelligence agencies, by our foreign policy. We basically allowed it there because we actually want it there, because then it helps us to get rid of the last secular Arab government. And then, of course, you see the after effect. We're extinguishing Christianity in the East, because wherever the Mujahideen get power, then they start breaking down the churches where secular or even the Arab monarchies in the past allowed them to continue to live. I mean, Syria is 20% Christian up until just recently. There's whole communities where the Muslims over here, Christians over here, they all respect each other, they go do their things, and nobody bothers each other for thousands of years, it seems. And then all of that's falling apart with the Mujahideen. And it seems to me that, at least in American politics, we keep wanting to support these politicians who are going to be tough on ISIS, right? Which they're not. And because it's their own assets they'll be putting out of the business. Tough on all these militants and bomb all these places. Nobody seems to care when innocent people die. As long as it's a Muslim, it's okay. Which seems to be a horrible violation of Catholic social teaching. Just because they're Muslim doesn't mean we should be rejoicing with some guy's kid is in pieces. But then over here, well, of course, we're a nation of immigrants, so we should allow immigrants in. It seems to me the real fight should be keeping Muslims out of our communities, not going over there and bombing them. What do you think about that? As well as Catholicizing our communities, I should add.
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more with you in that it's very strange that all these Muslims are making their way west. It's like, why is that when they got Saudi Arabia and all that oil money down there and their Muslim Brotherhood and these guys think alike, and why don't they welcome them in? You know, you come to us. It's never been like that. They're not welcoming to their own. It's like, find your own place. I don't know. You wonder if it's not on purpose.
Right. Or like Palestinian refugees, so-called, going abroad to Jordan and to Syria.
Lebanon.
They're locked up in camps. They don't go and just mix with the population. They're locked up and they're always refugees.
Well, and it's strange. So it's like they're coming to the West to accept them. And I couldn't agree more that this should not be allowed. But I also think it's by divine design, because we're being scourged. And the more we do not follow our laws and remain faithful, the more the Muslims will rise up and scourge us, even despite themselves and even despite ourselves. We will conflict with each other, and it's happening. Now, I just listened to a book by Brigitte Gabriel. I don't think she's the safest, but she's interesting. She lived in southern Lebanon, and she lived at the time in which the refugees started to come into the country, and they started to start the Muslim wars back in the 1970s. And her house was bombed, and they had to live in a bomb shelter from that point on. She's only like, I don't know, she's in her early teens and lived in a bomb shelter all the way until she was a major in her 18 or 19. And even in 20, and her parents were old. So she goes through how the Muslim immigrants came into Lebanon, which was a democratic society.
It was mostly Catholic, mostly Maronite Catholic.
Well, mostly Maronite. They had the highest position in the government. Then there was Sunni, whatever, Shiite, whatever. They all each had their own position based upon their population in the country. Of course, that's all been reversed. But she explains how it happened. It happened through immigration.
Right.
And she's trying to warn America. She went through step by step how it happened in Lebanon and how that's the exact same steps that are being used now. And so what she's trying to say is this is by design. This is not by accident. That's interesting. You know, why are we allowing these immigrants in? And if you look at what ISIS is doing to Obama, I mean, according to Robert Spencer, he's gone through it all in this book called The Politically In... No, not Politically... He does a wonderful book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. That's a great book.
I've seen it.
But he also has The Infidel's Guide to ISIS. And he shows in there that there's all these tweets and things by ISIS about how they're going to kill Obama and wipe him out, and they hate his guts. And here's Obama. Let in these immigrants. You think to yourself, this doesn't make any sense. Of course it makes sense. When you think in terms of Saul Alinsky and community organization and causing people to be upset. So if you've got a Christian base sitting in America, who can you pit against that base to get them to stir it up and to cause the conflagration they want so they can gain all the power? What, take it or leave it, that seems to be what's going on. Is Obama trying to make himself king? I refuse to believe that. Right. This is all part of a progressive...
I don't think he's smart enough. I think he's simply, you know, the least manager that's
exactly.
Going to go out to retirement in some island somewhere
exactly.
until the next manager comes
in. Exactly. I don't believe in these guys who say, oh, you know, Clinton is going to make things so he's going to be president forever. Bush is going to make things... No, these
guys...
He said
that every single time.
They did it every time. It's like, no, these guys are handing off the baton to the next guy. They're progressives. They're into progress.
Right.
And this is how to make progress. I make progress by getting a dialectic. So I get these guys over here to oppose the Christians and stir them up, and I get all this and I can control things. I think that's what's going on, but I think it's going to backfire on them because they're bringing in a beast that's wild and you cannot control him. The Ishmael is a wild ass of a man that nobody can control.
Right.
And so ultimately, we're not going to control this beast. He's going to get out of control. He's more violent and more willing to kill than we are willing to live. That's almost a direct quote from ISIS. They say they're more willing to die than we are to live. This is it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are dangerous. I mean, if you read that Infidel's Guide to ISIS and what they're doing in their own country, it's fascinating. It's like they'll kill people for smoking.
Mm-hmm.
They killed one of their security officers for smoking too much. They kept telling him, don't smoke,
now
don't
I know
smoke.
They're bad. No.
cut his head off and put a cigarette between his lips and said, this is what happens when you smoke. I mean, wow. I'm glad I'm in this country. It's all terror. They terrorize their own. They eat their own. But here's what I think about Muslims overall. I think it's very dangerous that to ever think of them as being peaceful, loving people. I think there's a number of historical examples of this, or types. And one of them would be Maryam of Jesus Crucified, who was canonized not too long ago, but she's beatified in her Pope John Paul II. And she was down in Alexandria, Cairo, in Egypt. Her mom and dad had died. She was from the Holy Land, and they call her the Little Arab. And she was living with her uncle, and he wanted to marry her off. She's like 13 or so, and maybe 14, something like that. And she says, no way, I'm not going to get married. And so the neighbors were going back to the Holy Land, which were Muslims. And she says, would you take me with you? And then she explained what happened to her. Her uncle wanted her to be married. And they said, we'll take you, no problem. And they were friends of the family. I think they were even servants in some way. And so then they said, why don't you just join Islam and be over with all this? And she said, Islam? Never. I'm a Catholic. I'd rather die. He took his knife out and cut her throat right there on the spot. That's a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the blue, they can rise up and just take the sword because they can do that. And they can do it without sinning.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of their Quran. They can do this at will when they choose. They can choose not to do it. And so he cut her throat, wrapped her in a blanket, threw her into an alley, and a lady picked her up, took her to a grotto, and healed her over 30 days and gave her a plan of life that she was going to go to France, into the Carmelites, and do all these things. And she became this great mystic, which she's a fascinating character study, all the things she did. But she had at her throat a scar. She died. She literally died. And Our Lady came and rescued her. Mm-hmm. But there's other stories like that too, where there's a Muslim next door, very friendly, and all of a sudden, well, I have to. This is part of jihad. I hated to kill my best friend neighbors, but I did because this is jihad. Mm-hmm. And they are, what do they call them? Kafir or something
Kafir.
Yeah, this is a horrible. Mm-hmm. But and that's what they have to do, jihad. I have to for the sake of the caliphate. Mm-hmm. So that's what's going on, I think, is that there are a dialectic. That's my view.
Right.
I think Obama is not a Muslim. I think all these people keep saying he's a Muslim. Don't get sidetracked. He is a communist thinker. Mm-hmm. He thinks like Saul Alinsky. He's always thinking in terms of how can I make the best advantage of a situation and bring about more power. That's Obama. You know, he's not. And I'm throwing this out. I'm not an expert in these things, and I throw this out with a caveat. But you know, it's interesting. Right before Obama got elected, there was all these concerns about gun control. And what happened? Everybody got armed. America is more armed than ever before. And none of those threats about gun control have hardly come true. It's like you think about that. That's sort of like 2000. You know, year 2000, right? Okay, all these threats and everything, but none of them came true. Mm. It's like, what's going on? How come America is more armed than ever, willing to pull the trigger more than ever before? I think we've been had. I think they want us armed. They want us to pull the trigger. They want this bedlam to break loose. And they're not ready for it, because every time something happens, they go, no, this wasn't the terrorist act, you know, calm down, you know, don't pull any triggers yet. It's kind of like, this. To me, I just think there's something very suspicious about all that. It's like something's in the offing. You just wonder where it's going to end. Hope it ends well. But okay, back to your other question about is the only good Muslim a dead Muslim? And that is certainly cannot be true. Even St. Catherine of Siena dealt with that directly about Muslims, how we should realize that even their souls have been redeemed by Christ. Objectively speaking, their redemption has been accomplished. And we should look upon them as prizes for the precious blood. And we should not despise their souls. Even though they are hateful people, they're filled with anger. And they can rise up at them at any moment in a way. If you read the Quran, it's a hateful document.
Right.
It's a very scary religion. Mm-hmm. Terror is their thing. Their fear. So, how to break through that? It's certainly, we cannot dialogue with them. Mm-hmm. We cannot invite them in.
Right.
Queen Isabella, as Elizabeth in our English language, Isabella and King Ferdinand realized that that's not the way to deal with Muslims.
Right.
They will convert, but you have to be, you know, willing to work with them and be careful. But
Cardinal Pallavicino, who's a famous historian of the Council of Trent, after the victory at Vienna, where they pushed the Turks back,
yes.
And they said, and bear in mind that the word Turk is a Bible word for Muslim at the time. He says that he wrote a book, actually have it, you can get it out of Google Books. It's in Italian, so if you read the dialect in that time, you can read it. And it's called The Present Prosperity of the Church. And in there, I'm just going to try to pull up my computer, I'll never get it at a reasonable time. In there, he talks about how, you know, God has favored us with this prosperity because we've survived this invasion and the Turks are going backward, but we should still be vigilant because, you know, a Turkish retreat is just a preparation for another war, right? So the best, you know, defense is always an offense, spiritual and temporal. And so ultimately that we have to be spiritually ready. And you look where the Jesuits were in that time. The Jesuits were going into all over the world trying to convert Muslims.
Absolutely.
There was one Jesuit, Cinieri, an Italian Jesuit. He was fluent in Arabic. And so he wrote a whole treatise on the Quran where he quotes the Quran directly and then refutes it by logic and reason in the scripture. And he goes back for it. And, you know, it seems like nobody's doing that kind of work anymore.
No.
You know, try to convert. There's Protestants doing it, and they're about the only ones. where there's actually a decent YouTube channel that used to be, if they haven't been shut down, where they would actually go into the Islamic sources and bring out all these things and show why, you know, these things are fictitious. One guy is a convert from Islam to Protestantism, the other guy is an evangelical, some strength, but they're really studied in the Islamic tradition. But you don't see Catholics doing that very much.
No, and I think the Summa Contra Gentile is used by St. Vincent Ferrer. I mean, right. He tried very hard to get the Muslims too, there in Spain, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And he converted many Muslims. Mm-hmm. I look upon the Muslims as the police force of God in a way. They're the devil's police force. I think of it like this, and that the devil gets us to sin by tempting us, and we go for it. We give in to abuses, whatever. And I think when it comes to the Muslims, it's got to be more high-level abuses, like of clergy, of bishops, of kings and whatnot. And when they abuse their power and they fail to do what they're supposed to do, then the devil gets permission, he goes to the divine courtroom, gets the permission, then he raises up his forces, which are the Muslims, and he pushes them into place to punish us and to bring us down and until he scourges us back to doing what we're supposed to do. So I think that's what's going on, is that the devil's got all the permissions he needs from our abuse, and they're going to be unstoppable. Mm-hmm. Despite themselves, they will push and do these things, and they'll... You know, Allah Akbar.
Allah Akbar is how it goes in Arabic.
Yeah, they're going to do that. And they're going to keep doing it. And they're going to keep coming in until we get straightened out. And I think a type of that is contained in St. Clare. Here she is, a faithful nun in a faithful convent. What does she do? She brings out the Eucharist and adores the Eucharist. And the Muslims flee. Mm-hmm. They have to run and they're blinded. And the power is too much. That's the key right there. When we're faithful to God, faithful to His Mass, faithful to what He's given us, and obedient, bang, they're going to fall back. Mm-hmm. And history has shown that huge numbers of Muslims are not to be feared. They will die like flies. They have no respect for life. They'll fall away like crazy. They'll kill each other. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't fear them. What we should fear is bad Catholics, and right. bad priests, and bad bishops, and bad popes. Mm-hmm. This is what we're afraid of.
Precisely.
We're living in a time in which, for the first time, the Pope has invited Muslims into Europe. Where all before, right. they were even the bad popes were saying, wake up, the Muslims are coming, let's right. get together and fight exactly. back.
Pope Pius II, actually, in the 15th century, you know, did that. You know, he was surprised everyone. He said, yes. the Turks, we got to worry about the Turks.
He tried to go down and get on the boat and go fight them.
Right.
Was he the one that
tried? He was the one, yeah, he was waiting at Ancona for it.
And he died, something like that.
Yeah, Aeneas Sylvius, who's a great humanist as well, Renaissance humanist, and became Pope. And then also Torquemada, he's a Latinized John Turk Ramada. Torquemada, he wrote a lot of, and people might know him from the Spanish Inquisition. Other people might know his Latin name if you've read Robert Bellarmine, because he quotes Torquemada all the time. It's just under the Latin name Turk Ramada.
Yeah.
And, but he also wrote a book against Islam as well, and warned of the dangers of Islam, because he was right there in the court with Isabel and Curtin.
Yes.
You know, and he, you know, wanted to help them draft the policy to expel all the Morsicles because they were such a danger.
Yeah.
And because it became apparent. Because he was the architect of the toleration of the Morsicos and incorporating them in a government, protectors along the lines of what the Normans did in Sicily. And, you know, and it didn't work.
It doesn't work.
And unlike today, you know, he said, okay, this isn't working, so we're going to change course. Whereas they can't do that anymore.
I'm Father Typology, but that Spain is a type of the Age of Peace that's in front of us.
Right.
And what they did, we need to do as a church.
Just not ruin it as they ruined it.
Yeah.
Later, you did not bring up a Charles V through the ranks. But then the next thing then is, opposed to this, what we've said about stopping Islamic immigration and whatnot, is you have the Pope, and not just this Pope. You also have Benedict, who said it, John Paul II, also who said it. You have bishops' conferences talking about immigration. You have liturgies for the immigrants now. That it was sort of, you have all these things that we got to welcome. And usually the forefront is, you're bringing all these Hispanic immigrants who are, and we don't get we don't get the faithful Hispanic families that are praying their daily rosaries and everything.
No.
You know, we get a few of those. We get the dissolute and the criminals that they're pushing out. Yeah. They don't want them down there. They want them up here.
Yes.
Right? And the same thing in the Islamic world, too. I mean, it seems like, you know, but yet you have the bishops' conference in this country, and it seems like in Europe, especially, and of course, up to the Pope. And as I mentioned, it's not just Francis, because we criticized the Holy Father very sharply earlier. So, but it's not just him. They're all talking about immigration. This is a church teaching. You must welcome immigrants.
It's ridiculous.
Don't sovereign states have the rights to manage and for the common good their own interior borders?
Absolutely. And what's one of the first jobs of a nation's government is to protect that nation and its patrimony.
Right.
And if they're opening the borders and ruining our patrimony, that's a sign that our government's no longer interested in our common
right.
welfare.
Exactly.
It's very dangerous. You know, and I used to work next to one of America's biggest army bases. Actually, they call them posts. And this one had a Green Beret group on it that worked in Arabia. It's called the 6th Group. The 6th Group Green Berets are the Arabic-speaking Green Berets. Obviously, they're in definite need.
Yes.
So one of the Green Berets I know, very good man, went into Iraq early before we declared war. And he came back. I mean, he went there numerous times, but he showed me these head cam videos that he had taken that was allowed to show me. And they were scary. And then he showed me what these Iraqis looked like that he was training to take over and to help keep order in the country. And I said, some of those guys look a lot like Mexicans. And he looked at me and he said, yes. And that's why they're going to try to come through the southern border of America. They look like Mexicans, and these terrorists can come across with ease. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking to yourself, oh my goodness, there's more than one reason why we should put a border control and not allow anybody and their dog to get over. And then we're not allowing everybody, but it just happens so much
right.
that we can't stop them.
Right.
I didn't know what to think about immigration.
Well, I worry about fences too, because with fences they can keep you in.
Yeah,
they
can keep you in, exactly.
With
but you know what? We're in a semi-police state now. I've been
right.
out of the country a couple times, and coming back in is more difficult than leaving, which is interesting.
I just left the country about a month ago and came back in. It's
more hard to get in now than to get out. It's strange. I used to think it was hard to get to another country. They give you a hard time. They don't. They give you a hard time coming in. But I listened to Pat Buchanan's book, The State of Emergency, and I didn't know what to think about immigration. But after listening to that book, I thought, oh, he's right. There's so many things to consider that people are not considering.
Even the justice to the immigrants, the ones that are actually coming because they do want to work, well, because they're not documented, they can be taken advantage of.
They can
be paid a pittance.
Yes.
They can be, and girls can be sold into slavery. It happens all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sex slavery.
Yes.
Where politicians are wonderful politicians.
Yes.
And all these networks that run right through this country, pedophilia and sex slave networks, and they're very big running this country, people don't realize it.
Yes.
And what about the justice to those people?
Yes.
And the bishops never talk about that.
And they never talk about the justice. These just the landowners down there.
Right.
They suffer terribly from these people crossing their land. It just destroys their land constantly. It's just so frustrating to own land along the border.
Right.
You're constantly dealing with trash and all sorts of stuff that's wrong. It's ruining everything they own. I think that's terrible. If you lived down there, you would hate that. It's so unjust. So the whole thing is wrong. And that's why, you know, a presidential candidate who's proposing some kind of limitations and serious about it starts to come into focus.
Right.
He starts to become attractive. You start thinking, at least he cares about
right.
the American in whom he's getting elected for.
Even though he doesn't.
You know, you wonder if he's...
sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good. And you wonder if they're going to follow through with it.
Right.
But, you know, when you start talking like that, you think that person's going to get elected just for that alone.
Right. And you think so. Or else, the only thing is with that particular individual is that most of his positions, he's largely indistinguishable from Hillary.
Yeah.
And that's the scary thing. His wife's posing nude in various magazines. Although, then again, maybe that's a great political ploy, because given where most of the American electorate is, that's a great way to get votes.
God save us. We're in big trouble.
It's just a very sad thing. And like I said, on that very last note, I guess a Catholic, especially conservative and many traditional Catholics, are kind of stuck in this position of default Americanism, where America is the greatest country it ever was and ever will be, and so we have to, you know, we have to go back to the Constitution all the time. We have to, there's this constant emphasis on how great America is, but if you stop and you look back, and I'm great, I love my country, otherwise I wouldn't, you know, criticize it, because you want it to be better.
Yes.
But we're the number one exporter of pornography.
Yes.
The number one exporter of child pornography.
Yes.
And, you know, more instances of pedophilia in the United States, at least in terms of reporting, than in other countries in the world.
And we're also forcing, you know, homosexuality in
right.
other countries through the International Monetary Fund
right.
and things like that. We're doing all that stuff. We're doing many things that we don't know. The general judgment will release all that. This is the baby of the revolution. This is the revolutionary country. And because it opened the doors so much, we're allowed so much freedom in here to be Catholic to a certain degree,
right,
that we like it, that we can freely exercise. But those days may be coming to an end. But we can't confuse that with the ultimate principles of things, that this country is based upon revolutionary principles that are wrong, and they are failing, and we have to admit that. But I think it comes back again to your original idea that politics is local, or we should work locally. You know,
subsidiarity in the church's proper tradition.
Exactly. And patriotism is love of your fatherland.
Right.
But what do we love? We love where we live. We love this area. We love this, you know, we want to preserve this. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking so much about Florida, maybe.
Right.
You know, that's their job down there. Exactly. In America. So, you know, patriotism extend to the 50 states? In a certain way, I suppose it does. But, you know, America, right or wrong, you know, hey, they're suffering down in Florida. Let's get up a big old army up here in our country in Idaho and go down there and take care of them. Oftentimes people aren't thinking those terms. So patriotism, traditionally understood, maybe doesn't quite extend to the limits of the American boundary. I don't know if that's quite, you know, something to think about, something to explore maybe. But I think that, you know, you can be patriotic without having to get involved in, you know, all these. In other words, I love my country. I love where I live. But I wouldn't want to live in California.
Right.
You see, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to put it. I think there's something there that right. has been extended. We've been forced on us. You must love America. She's right. Whether right or wrong, love your country. It's like, yeah, I love my country, but not that way.
Right. It seems to contrast so sharply with, say, in the 19th century, with, you see, look at a figure like Bishop Hughes, who just triumphantly declared Catholicism will conquer every state.
Exactly.
It will conquer the Congress. It will conquer the presidency.
Yes.
It will conquer all
yes.
nations. But today, Catholics said, well, that's just un-American. We couldn't want
exactly.
that. And but if you're Catholic, you do want that.
Well,
so it seems we have this conflict.
If you look at the Muslims, that's all the things they want to do.
Right.
If you look at the Muslims, it is mockery of the Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
They want a universal caliphate. What does the Catholic Church want? The church be one flock, one, or the one flock, one shepherd, the whole world. We're doing the same things. Ours is under the gentle reign of Christ the King. Theirs is under Muhammad and the caliphate. And you must submit, you know, and it's very similar. They have their priests, we got our priests. They got their court judicial system, we got our judicial system. They got their book, we got our book.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over the place. Their memory is long. They remember their caliphate. They want to recover their caliphate. Before they can do offensive jihad, they must do defensive jihad, get back their caliphate. How do Catholics think? We believe that old dioceses should never be forgotten. So all the cardinals and bishops that aren't connected to a direct see that's operative, they're connected to some see that's not. You know, there is a bishop for Carthage
right.
and Hippo and all these places that are no longer operative. There's still a bishop for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very similar. There's a lot of similarities. They've got their saints, we've got our saints.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their tradition, we've got our tradition. They got their form of confession. You know, the sand and all
yeah.
that stuff. They've got their beads, we got our beads. You know, in a way, what they're doing, in some sense, is right.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get the caliphate to be worldwide. We should be thinking in those terms for the Christ the King. And we're not. And that's why they're scourging us. Because until we get back to Christ as King everywhere, they're going to try to put their caliphate over top of us.
Exactly. Well, Father Ioannis Petrus, thank you for joining us again. It was great.
It's been a pleasure, Ryan. God reward you.
Thank you.
Thank you.